Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith. He's an author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, and The Nearly Free University in the Emerging Economy. Also, Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic. Another, Will You Be Richer or Poorer? And his most recent book that we will today focus on is called Global Crisis, National Renewal, A Revolutionary Grand Strategy for the United States. And his blog of twominds.com is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. I'm very pleased and grateful that you are willing to talk about my new book. And I just want to sort of set the context for why I wrote the book and what it's about. And I say it's a grand strategy for the United States, but it's actually a template based on systems, the way that systems operate. It's a template for any nation that wants to survive and emerge stronger in terms of adaptability and flexibility in the crises, which I consider we're already embedded in that are global. And I would call those like inequality and scarcity. And so it's, even though I discuss the United States, it's really any country could use the same template. And I use the word grand strategy, and that usually has a geopolitical context. You know, we usually talk about grand strategy about countering geopolitical rivals or this kind of thing, military power. But I think I'm using it in a little broader term, which is in national security in the broadest sense, which includes the security of the domestic society and economy. You know, we tend to forget that geopolitical power comes from your domestic economy and society. And if those fragment and break apart, you're not going to have any geopolitical power. So the grand strategy has to focus not just on, you know, geopolitical concerns and rivals, but also on your domestic order.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've divided the book into first discussing what has happened, right? The problem we're in now, the challenges that we're in now. Before you get to the grand strategy, can you detail that part of the first part of the book in terms of where we're at today, how we got there?
Yeah, thank you so much. One of my premise in writing the book is to look at the nation state and its economy and society as systems. In other words, to kind of pull back and not try to look at things like from an ideological perspective, but look at them as a system, because if you can look at, break a system down, then you can understand its dynamics more objectively than if you're looking at it through the lens of some ideological perspective. And so I think, what's the point of having a nation state? What is a nation state? And my premise is it's a problem-solving structure. In other words, all social structures arise to solve problems. And most of those problems arise from scarcity of resources and capital and what I call agency, like who gets the say in the decisions that affect everyone, right? So every social structure from hunter-gatherer groups up to city-states, nations, or global empires, they all succeed because they're a solution to those issues of how do we get enough resources for our population, how do we distribute capital, and how do we distribute agency, like who has a say and who doesn't have a say. And so if the nation-state is no longer solving the problems, then it's going to be replaced with some other solution, right? And so what I think the book is about is answering the question, what are the the primary threats facing the United States and other nation states. And so one of them is political polarization and social disorder that could lead to fragmentation and basically dissolution of the United States. In other words, it breaks up as a nation state into smaller pieces that are more manageable and that the residents feel are better solutions than this gigantic nation state. So, you know, that's an idea that a lot of people are talking about, and maybe you can shed some light on why that is. You know, like, why is that now in the media more than it ever was before?
Yeah, I think there seems to be a frustration among the population that, you know, why can't we solve problems? Why can't we, you know, come to solutions? And then it creates this polarization because, you know, people will tend to blame a group or each other on why it's not happening. And I think the idea that the polarization that you mentioned is very interesting. I think that it's caused by factors such as the country being run or with a large influence by very groups of special interest group lobbyists, you know, that have a significant influence on politicians, on different areas of the government. And so, you know, people will try to effectuate change through the political process, right, through the election process, democratic process, but then they're not getting any results. So I see that as happening over the last several years, several decades, where, you know, they will vote for somebody and then they thought they had that person in power, then that person can no longer do much. And then they vote the other way, it goes to the other direction. And so I think there's a general frustration, right? So and so this is manifested through that polarization that you mentioned.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. The frustration is, as you say, has two sources. One is the system just doesn't work anymore. I mean, and there's so many examples. Like it takes, in the U.S., it takes 20 or 25 years to get a bridge built, you know, or a subway line, or these kinds of basic infrastructure projects take decades if they're completed at all. And that's just a tip of an iceberg of things that simply don't work that should work. And so there's a frustration there. And then there's also, as you say, the frustration of this, the stress that's being imposed on the bottom 90% by this elite, this self-serving elite you mentioned, is that virtually all the wealth and power are being accumulated at the top of the pyramid, right? At the top 10% own, you know, 80 to 90% of all the productive assets. They the top 0.1% owns virtually all the political power. And of course, there's studies on this. There's been political social science studies that show that the political system in the U.S. does not respond to the voters. It responds virtually solely to these self-serving elites that have the lobbyists and the campaign contributions and the money. And other studies have found that this kind of soaring inequality that we're discussing, it leads to social breakdown, fragmentation, and collapse throughout history. And so before we started recording, we were discussing human nature, and this is really what we're talking about. When you strip people of political power or a voice, they have no say in the decisions that impact them. If you create a system that's patently structurally unfair, so very few people can get ahead, and it rewards those who are already wealthy and in power, then you're going to break apart your society because these are intolerable. So I think that's the source, the one of the key sources that we as a nation, at every nation, has to deal with. How do you deal with vast structural inequality, which has only gotten more extreme, as you say, over the decades? And then the second thing that I think is misunderstood is scarcity. And there's been a lot of books, David Hackett Fisher, Peter Turchin, a lot of historians have looked at the cycles in which societies come under stress, economies start breaking down, stagnating, the standard of living declines sharply. And then you get all these manifestations of stress. You get civil disorder, you get civil wars, you get wars of conquest, you get social breakdown. And these are all because people's standard of living is declining rapidly. And I think we're experiencing that. And I've written a lot about this recently, and we've talked about it. I think the scarcity is, some of it's engineered, of course, but a lot of it is not engineered. It's the fact that the human population on the planet has doubled, and the number of people that want or expect a middle-class lifestyle with lots of high energy consumption and material wealth has skyrocketed, and we're having difficulty meeting all those needs. And then there's geopolitical tensions over these scarce minerals and resources like cobalt and rare earth minerals. And so nation states are optimized for abundance, right? That's really been the case for the last at least 200 years, right? Nation states get more resources. They have a larger population earning more money. So there's higher taxes, tax revenues. And so I don't think nation states are prepared structurally to deal with a decline in living standards and scarcity. That's not what they're set up for. So we need a massive change in the way that we govern ourselves and distribute resources and capital and agency. If we're going to deal with a period of declining resources and declining standards of living.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think also the idea of not aligning with elements of human nature, you know, structuring an economic system that is aligned with human nature, not doing that is a mistake. So if you try to just simply do controls or restrictions on people's behavior or freedom of speech, right? It's not going to work in the end. People are not going to be happy, and it's just going to fail. So at the same time, too, there needs to be an emphasis on education and engineering, especially to address scarcity. That's the idea that applying education and engineering makes increasingly scarce resources go farther, so that you can increase your standard of living. You can meet the challenges, as you mentioned, of rising populations or limited commodities, limited resources. So that helps and. I think these factors go into your strategy as well.
Right. And I want to I also discuss the idea that part of why inequality creates such destructive social disorder is that those with the power and the capital, of course, they'll fight tooth and nail to keep the system exactly as it is. They're ill-prepared to see themselves as the problem, right? They think, well, you know, if we get more power and more wealth, then we'll be able to solve the problems, you know? And of course, they can't recognize that they are themselves the problem. And I think we can say that the nation state that's dominated by parasitic elites is itself a problem. In other words, it's not going to be the solution. It is itself the problem. So we have tremendous resistance within the system for making any kind of fundamental reforms, right? Because the elites that are benefiting from the current arrangement will look at any kind of change as a threat to their power and control and wealth. And so they're going to resist it and water it all down. And so the other strategy that they use, and we see it, you know, daily, both in politics and in governance, is basically magical thinking. So we're going to just print trillions of dollars and distribute it as bread and circuses, and that's going to solve the problems, right? Well, we all know that's magical thinking. Or we're going to create speculative bubbles that are going to create a wealth effect, and then everyone's going to feel wealthy, and that's going to solve the problem. And of course, speculative bubbles are not a solution either. That's magical thinking. And then I think energy, we all know it's going to be a long, difficult, expensive transition from depending largely on fossil fuels or hydrocarbon to other sources of energy. But instead of actually having a pragmatic plan, then the political elites are embracing magical thinking, like we're going to get rid of fossil fuels in a few years, and you know, we're going to live on, you know, solar panels and windmills, and this is just impractical. And so they're setting the system up for failure, not for success. And so to your point about what happens when elites try to suppress dissent or people disagreeing with their control or their path, I think we have to look at it as a system. And any human system depends on these five elements for its structural integrity and adaptability. In other words, if you take a human system, whether it's an economy or a sphere of governance, and if it has the ability to adapt and problem solve, that's a successful system. If you've stripped out all of those dynamics of adaptation and problem solving, then that system's going to fail. And these dynamics of adaptability are transparency, competition, accountability, variability, and dissent. These are all the essentials of systemic stability. And what we, in systems terms, we call that systemic stability that comes from experimentation, variability, and quick adaptation and evolution. In other words, the more you lock your system down, the more you make it stagnant and sclerotic, where it's resistant to change, the more you're dooming your system, because you've stripped out all of the dynamics and functionality of adaptability, because that's really what we need to optimize is fast adaptation and evolution. And this is true of species and natural systems. And of course, being a human nature, we're part of that natural world. And so I think that if you want a system, a political or economic system that's going to be sustainable and problem solving, you have to ensure that there's transparency, competition, accountability, and dissent. And of course, these are all the elements that have been stripped out of the American political and economic system. You've got no transparency. You've got no competition. It's run, you know, most of the economy is controlled by monopolies and cartels. You have very little accountability, you know, too big to fail, no problem, we'll bail you out. Very little variability. You know, we have two parties, we have two telecoms, we have, you know, two social media companies. You know, there's very little variability because that goes along with experimentation and these other elements. And then we're dissent is now kind of a simulacrum of dissent. Dissent's only allowed within a very narrow range of what's considered acceptable. So I see the main problem, Richard, is the status quo serves the interests of special interests that are self-serving elites, and they are basically suppressing all the dynamics that create that are essential to a sustainable adaptive system. So they're basically creating a situation where the system has no possible future except breakdown and collapse.
Yeah, absolutely. And a successful system, in order to survive, if we think in the Darwinian sense, you know, has to adapt. Right? If you don't adapt, then you'll die.
Yeah.
So it's just got to be adaptable in that sense. And also these other elements are taken all together, as you mentioned. And this is even on a super national level, of the idea of no accountability. If you think of, you know, some of these nonprofit organizations now, either set up as charities or nonprofits, have actually had some issues of governance in terms of how they invest or who they invest with, covering all kinds of aspects of what they're trying to do, and it just morphs into these issues that represent the failings of those five characteristics: transparency, competition, accountability, variability, and dissent. And that brings us to where we're at today.
Right. And I will say right up front that, of course, I've been influenced by, as with many other people, by Nassim Taleb's concept of anti-fragile. And of course, his whole idea of anti-fragility is that the system, has these characteristics that we're describing, that the system protects transparency, competition, accountability, variability, and dissent as the core elements of systemic problem solving and stability. And if you replace those with a monolithic, centrally controlled system, then the system loses the flexibility and adaptability it needs to survive, and so then it collapses. So I think we're looking at I would phrase it like this: every nation state serves a population, of its citizenry, right, the residents. And I think that nation states around the world are being faced with a choice that they either have to take back their country from these parasitic, self-serving elites, or their country's going to fragment and collapse, economically, socially, and politically. Because as what we're talking about here is, if you take out all the elements that keep a system healthy and you eliminate all those as threats to the ruling elite, then your system has the only one possible outcome, which is collapse. And so to save that your country from collapse, you're going to have to take it back. And you're going to have to transform the economy to what I and many other people call degrowth. And degrowth is poorly understood. It comes from the French root word décroissance. And it doesn't mean that we're all going to be living in huts and eating grubs. It simply means doing more with less. Right. And this means rejecting the dominant economic ideology, which is what I call waste is growth. In other words, it used to be 100 years ago, or even 50 years ago, that a product was manufactured to be extremely durable, to last for decades, and to improve the well-being of the person who bought the product, right? Well, now we have planned obsolescence, which everything is designed to break down in a few years, be impossible to repair. Wow. And this generates what I call a landfill economy. Stuff is made somewhere, it's shipped here, you own it for a few years, then it breaks down, and then it's transferred to the landfill as junk. And so this is what I call a waste is growth economy. And this is catastrophic. This is the basis of our so-called growth economy. We're not growing in terms of measuring well-being or sustainability. We're only growing in waste. And so we're going to have to change that kind of economic ideology to something that instead of rewarding waste and planned obsolescence, we reward durability, sustainability, reusing materials, getting more value and utility out of the resources we consume.
Yes, that's absolutely the case. And as I mentioned earlier, education and engineering can help in that regard, in terms of being, more efficient, more sustainable, doing more with less, right? Diminishing resources, making diminishing resources go farther.
Right. And if we look at how problems are solved, and I draw upon my own experience in small community groups, is actually if you push the power to problem solve and implement solutions down to the lowest possible level in local markets and local governance, then you get the churn, you know, the creative churn where you can experiment at that local level and very quickly, you know, fail fast, fail often. That kind of philosophy plays out in local politics and local markets. You can find out what works for in your community and your local economy, and then you can implement it. And then other people can learn from you, and they may have to, it may not work for them exactly, but, and so I think that if you look at governance as problem solving, you've got to push the power down to the local level and allow this kind of diversity of experimentation and problem solving and let and give them the power and capital to implement it. And so this means a completely different model of the nation state, where I think the central state really has to go back to a model that was popular, say, in the 18th century, where the central state controlled maybe setting the goals, you know, like we want to become more efficient. You know, the central state could implement a goal like we need to improve the efficiency of our economy. And we're going to set up incentives for that. And we're going to set up disincentives for wasting resources and capital. And so, but then how to reach those goals would be left to the local governments. And I think that, that is the key to the revolutionary grand strategy, is to devolve power to the local level. And in terms of systems, we're talking about taking away the power to run all the transactions and capital through a few nodes, right? Because if you have a network system and everything runs through a few nodes, when those nodes break, then the whole system collapses, right? That's the system we have today, globalization, neoliberalism, et cetera. So if you want a robust, adaptable, sustainable system, you've got to put the power and the capital into a huge number of nodes that are connected to each other, right? That's a sustainable, robust, adaptable system. So that's really the system I'm proposing.
Yeah, exactly. And so the idea is basically to think and to plan, you know, globally, but to act locally in the implementation of those strategies and plans, as you mentioned.
Yes,
the principles of that are also embodied in what we call market environmentalism versus agenda-based environmentalism, or versus centralized environmentalism, like the Soviet Union tried. You know, it's much better to consider principles of market environmentalism, and those specifically are local decentralized solutions and applying innovation and technology rather than trying to control people's behavior or put social controls in that people are not happy to do. You know, it makes much more sense. And also people that are local, where you implement localized solutions, those are likely to be much more successful than a centralized approach. People that are local to the scene, to where that problem is happening in the environment, for example, they know what's going on. They have the knowledge. They know what solution can work, you know, rather than somebody managing it 1,000 kilometers away, never been there in their life, and they have no idea what's going on, what the local challenges are. So it makes much more sense having that localized and decentralized approach.
Right, and that's what Taleb says, his famous use of the term skin in the game. In other words, everybody local has skin in the game, whereas everyone far away has no skin in the game, right? Especially if they're not accountable. So to your point about decentralized, if we're going to have a nation state anywhere on Earth, that is adaptable and sustainable, then I think it's going to have what I call coherence. And this is a system term, right? That we call, like if you have an island of coherence in an incoherent system, that island of coherence will influence the rest of the system much more than we might think. And so the coherence that I'm proposing as part of the grand strategy is the coherence of the state, economy, and society, that all these three elements have to share the same purpose and goals. And this is the root of like social cohesion. In other words, people have to feel that their work is going towards a common good, right? Not just being survival or enriching some billionaires, you know, and that willingness to sacrifice and for the common good of the society is what's been destroyed, you know, by the inequality that we've discussed. You know, and so all social groups function out of cooperation, and whether it's a hunter-gatherer group or a nation state. And so I think that I'm proposing that we have to think of it as a system that's seeking coherence. And right now we have only incoherence, you know, that the state, the economy, and the society don't share the same purposes and goals. And there's no social cohesion is being lost. There's no willingness to sacrifice or even focus on the common good, although many people give lip service to that. So, you know, when we were discussing this, the topics before we started recording, you used the term Great Awakening. And I think that's a terrific, concept as to how you could get this kind of social, economic, political coherence. So maybe you can speak to what you mean by the Great Awakening.
Yeah, it embodies a number of aspects, but essentially it's the idea of a realization of you know, where we've been and how we evolved into these problems and challenges, as you speak to, as you write a lot about. So you know, that would be the first aspect of it, the realization of the problem, and then moving to a realization or understanding of what the potential solutions are. And you've outlined that in your strategy, as well as in your many other books, in terms of ideas and solutions, you know, on addressing all of these challenges. So I think that Great Awakening is quite apropos a term, because it sort of represents also the cohesion, as you just mentioned, the unified view, right? The societal elements are on the same wavelength, and we're moving to those five areas you mentioned, right? So we're not trying to be non-transparent. We're moving towards transparency. We're not trying to have or to limit competition. We're not trying to do regulatory capture, right, in organizations, but we're allowing competition to fuel new ideas, new technologies, and accountability as well. So we're moving to accountability. We're not just making decisions without any accountability. And there's a governance structure in place, not only at a national level, but at an international level. I think there's a big problem that's happened recently, and what we've been seeing in the last year or two here, where there needs to be more of an international governance on, like, nonprofit organizations, how they operate, how they can invest, who they invest in, who they provide donations to. Because it ends up with lots of conflicts of interest if you don't address that accountability and variability you know, being able to adapt quickly and easily to solve problems, and most importantly, dissent, right? We've been seeing that type of suppression of dissent more and more in the last year or two in so many ways, as the you know, all of the other five aspects of the four I just mentioned are tried to kept in place, right? Non-transparent, non-competitive, non-accountable, and non-variable type of industries, of governments, institutions.
Yeah, exactly. And what I like about your term, the Great Awakening, is it's like, of course, this is very similar to large religious movements that arose in the 18th and 19th centuries. And I think that without saying it has to be a faith-based movement, I think what people, again, human nature, we want to be part of something positive, right? We want to belong to something positive. And so it's our, I think we have the potential for an inspirational movement that shares values, purposes, and goals that are serving the common good as opposed to serving special interests. And I think people could, if once they adopt these ideas and then find inspiration in them, that we could see a global movement that isn't run from the top down, that's actually from the bottom up. And that's how you get real solutions, in my view.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the key, as you mentioned, also to the strategy that you've put together. And if you can also relate, you mentioned the key to geopolitical dominance is not military power, which depends on the stability of society and its resources. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, thank you. And that'll, I'll probably finish up there, is that, you know, this obsession with geopolitical maneuvering and soft power, like financial power and hard power, like military power, as if that's all that a nation state needs to defend itself or protect its interests. All of those things, soft and hard power, all derive from your domestic economy and social cohesion. And when you lose your social cohesion and your economy stagnates, then your military power decays as well, because you simply don't have the national will. You don't have the resources to project power. So if you want global influence, then going forward, then what you want is you want that coherence of your nation state, your society, and your economy. And the military power is not the critical element. It's actually social cohesion, because if your society fragments, you're not going to have any military power. So I just want to mention at the end here that if you're interested in the book, there's the introductions on my website, and so is the first chapter, about 11,000 words, that lays out much of what we've discussed. But there's quite a bit more in the book, and so feel free to read the first chapter and see what you think of it.
Well, great. The name of the book, again, is Global Crisis, National Renewal, A Revolutionary Grand Strategy for the United States. And as you mentioned, it applies to any nation in the world.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Richard. I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk about my book.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Charles.